Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Hello and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, broken pipes need engineers, not election promises. Imported oxtail hits a border bottleneck just as winter starts to bite. The insurance risks that are set to shape the rest of 2026. And a new premium aerodrome gives Cape Aviation some room to grow. It's Tuesday, the 14th of July. Now, with local government elections just months away, South Africans are asking a familiar question. Will new political promises finally translate into functioning water systems, reliable sanitation, and better infrastructure? The South African Institution of Civil Engineering says the real challenge is no longer diagnosing what's broken. I guess we know that. But building the systems, building the skills and the accountability needed to fix it. Someone who's applied her mind to that is Sekadi Payani Sakani, who's Chief Executive Officer of the organization. Sekadi, a very warm welcome. And you'll agree with me. We keep hearing about water shortages, sewage spills, failing infrastructure. At what point, and maybe this is a philosophical start here, at what point do we stop calling this a crisis and actually refer to it as a systemic failure?
Thank you very much for this opportunity. I completely agree with you. All the research, all the drop reports from government have also shown that we are beyond a critical state. Currently, we're in a systematic breakdown, as you have called it. So we are there. We are there now because as much as these are technical failures from an infrastructure perspective, it's also a governance architecture that ensures that these technical failures keep happening.
So is it governance architecture? Because you also say the blueprint to fix local government already exists. If that is true, why then are we struggling to deliver basic services? Is it all about governance?
I think so, and we believe that from SAICI's perspective, we believe that fundamentally governance problems come with engineering consequences. So under the current constitutional setup, municipalities hold all the protected mandates for water, for sanitation and electricity, and even when they lack the technical capacity to deliver them. So it means that the system protects the dysfunction instead of protecting the residents' rights to water services, electrical services as well. So we do believe that from a governance perspective, there needs to be a lot of rework that is happening, and which is what the white paper on local government is also saying, which we agree with.
So am I overreaching here when I say that municipalities should simply lose responsibility for water and sanitation? Are we at that point?
We are. We are definitely at that point. We have to technically safeguard our assets. So the ability to reassign functions like water reticulation when a municipality is not coping and they don't have the correct technical team to ensure that they can deliver these should be taken away from them. And that's exactly what the white paper is also saying. So we really want to see a point in South Africa where we move from policy and we actually start actioning what the policy is saying and see municipalities start losing these functions and them being reassigned to entities that can take up these responsibilities and ensure that we keep up with service delivery and infrastructure asset management.
You will concede, though, that that could be politically explosive. How do you take powers away from elected structures without undermining local democracy?
That is so true, and that we will leave to government to sort out. But I think National Treasury right now has started with incentivizing models for municipalities. So instead of punishing, they almost incentivize them. If you have technical capacity, tick. If you are performing, tick. And then they give you more money, if I can put it that way. So it's almost like a transition period that we're going through to get to what we finally see as a model that will work towards infrastructure asset management.
You've also called for professional registration to be mandatory for senior technical posts. Do you think that unqualified appointments are still the significant factor behind infrastructure failure?
Yes, definitely. Also, what we always say is that senior technical roles in municipalities must be filled by professionally registered engineers and technologists. You realize that when you're professionally registered, you have a personal accountability for infrastructure decisions. And there's someone who holds you responsible, which is your regulator, whether it's the South African Construction, SACPCMP, or the Engineering Council of South Africa. And without this personal accountability and having almost like a big brother overlooking what you do on a day-to-day basis, then there is no accountability. So we really believe that with this governance framework, South Africa will be able to get engineers to come and solve engineering problems and ensure that we have effective service delivery. The Engineering Council of South Africa has also now started implementing its identification of engineering work regulations. So any engineering work in South Africa must be undertaken by professionally registered engineers and technologists.
You also, if I've read this correctly, support longer terms for municipal managers. And you'll need to explain that to me, because I would suggest that South Africans might not have confidence that longer tenure won't simply entrench poor performance.
I think there's a problem with consequence management. And because of the problem with consequence management and holding people to account and ensuring that like some of the key performance indicators are not just, leadership, etc., but like in terms of infrastructural performance, that is why we have that mistrust. But having longer terms will ensure that the municipal manager has a long-term view of what it is that they're doing. And it will help them also to go from being more annual project oriented, like what is currently happening, to being more long-term oriented in terms of what the municipality is and the work that the municipality is doing in terms of program management and the infrastructure programs that they want to undertake. We're seeing more and more long-term planning that is taking place. I can use an example being the city of Cape Town, where they have 5 to 10 year plans for infrastructure development. And we believe that having this long-term leadership overview will give that particular person an opportunity to see their programs through. So if you have that and you have like proper consequence management and review of performance linked to these outputs that come out of these long-term programs, then you can justify having longer terms of municipal managers.
Let me ask you one last question. You've put a lot of ideas on the table, but I wonder if the numbers don't count against you. Municipalities currently have more than 7,000 vacancies in the water sector alone. Sikadi, how realistic is it to expect a turnaround when the skills pipeline that you've already referenced is already under such pressure?
It is not easy. It really is not easy. I think from all sectors, that's why this problem is not just a municipal problem. It's a South African problem. From all sectors, we are doing our part to ensure that the skills pipeline is being mentored and capacitated to get to a place where we have proper skills and with enough experience to be able to deal with the crisis that we're in terms of capacity, perspective. There's a lot of also retired engineers and technologists who also want to assist in this and to mentor people who are quite young and coming up the ladder. I think the people are there. We probably do not have enough professionalized persons, like professionally registered ones. And as I said, we're doing a lot of work in terms of capacitation and mentoring and ensuring that people are coming through the professional registration cycles. But it is, you know, it is a long-term project, if I can put it that way. I don't think in terms of the turnaround that we will see a turnaround in the next 2 or 3 years. But if the infrastructure or the frameworks are put in place, then in the next 5 to 10 years, we can see a turnaround in terms of service delivery within our municipalities. Mm. I mean, this problem did not happen 2 years ago. You know, it's taken like 10 to 15 years of dysfunction for us to get to where we are now.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Sekadi Payani Shakane, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Institution of Civil Engineering.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's favorite winter comfort food has hit a paperwork problem. Argentine oxtail exports, which supply a large part of the local market, have been delayed because of a wording error on a sanitary certificate. Now, the industry says the delay could cost the market something in the region of 1,000 tons of product and about 100 million rand this winter. That's a lot of money. So is this a bureaucratic mistake or is there something more going on? I want to talk to Etienne Nordia from the Association of Meat Importers and Exporters South Africa. Etienne, welcome to you. Let's start with the basics. Very simply, what has gone wrong with these imports?
Hi, Jeremy. So, yes, essentially what's happened with these imports is that it's come down to a very administrative, bureaucratic problem. So there has been an outbreak in Argentina in what is called ovine scrappy disease. Now, this disease only affects lamb and goat. It does not have any effect on cows. So what has happened is that South Africa's health certificate with the Argentinians, there's a clause there that states that the country has to be free from ovine scrappy disease for the importation of beef and oxtails. So that's essentially where the problem has now come in, that in our paperwork, there is a disease listed that does not affect the animal. Now, the vets in Argentina cannot sign off on any exports coming to South Africa. So essentially, that's where we have asked the department to just remove that clause, as it does not affect the cows, and just for exports out of Argentina to South Africa just to proceed.
So, Etienne, a simple wording error, why has it taken so long and why is it putting 100 million rand at risk? It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, so we as the Association of Meat Imports and Exporters have now approached with the Embassy of Argentina. We have approached the Department of Agriculture to request them just to remove this scrappy disease clause for trade to commence again. But what has happened is South Africa have then responded in a very complex manner, including a whole bunch of foot and mouth regulations for the Argentinians now to look at and evaluate in terms of the health certificate. So we've been importing beef from Argentina for many years now, and now they've had this outbreak of a disease, and we've requested for them to remove it. But the South African Department of Agriculture has now come back trying to put in a whole bunch of different regulations for FMD and just complicated the matter.
Given that FMD has been a problem in South Africa and continues to be one, do you think the department is being unnecessarily and overly cautious or just being prudent in terms of managing risk?
Yeah, so I'd put this down to not being too overly cautious. I mean, we in South Africa are facing our own FMD problem at the moment, where the Argentinians are actually supplying South Africa with vaccines and assistance in getting our FMD under control. So it would not seem that that would be an issue because we have the disease in this country and there's no risk from Argentina at this stage. So it just seems like it's a bureaucratic issue that they just need to sort out at the department, which should be such a simple thing that has now turned into a country-to-country renegotiation almost of a health certificate, which can take months and months to resolve.
How important, Etienne, is Argentina to South Africa's supply of oxtail?
So Argentina supplies approximately 70% of South Africa's oxtail. So they've always been a big supply of South Africa, especially during the winter months where you see a lot more imports, just because us as South Africans, I mean, we love oxtails and the consumer loves it. And that would just, then the imports do increase over those months, but there's a steady supply coming in all the time. So it's quite an important partner for us in terms of, especially on the oxtail side, just because we don't produce that much quantity in South Africa just to meet the market demands.
And if these specific imports don't come in, do you believe local producers can make up the shortfall, or is that window closed?
Yeah, so I don't think they'd be able to make up the shortfall, especially now in this time where they are having their own struggles with foot and mouth disease. And just in terms of the supply, that the demand in South Africa is quite high for oxtails, especially during these months. So what you'll see will happen now, and I mean, the consumers would have seen it already, is that the retailers, the price of oxtail will just increase, and it's already increased. And that's the way where, you know, the retailers are trying to just curb the demand, because there is still oxtails, but it's running very short. So they're trying to increase the price to bring the demand a little low so they can have the supply. But without it, the prices are just going to keep going up.
So what price increases have we seen now, and what are we likely to see if the problem persists?
So a couple of, just to give you a bit of an example, a couple of months ago, we were looking at oxtails at about 87 rand a kilo. And just in recent weeks, we've seen it go up to 120 rand a kilo already. So it's just going to keep going up. In terms of projections, I don't have exact figures that it will get to. But without this, the incoming oxtails and the prices are just going to keep going up, and it's going to become just unaffordable. But the biggest problem here is that the window is so short, because the it takes a few months to get the shipments from Argentina into South Africa, that you'll just miss the window. If this problem isn't resolved as soon as possible, then the contracts will just expire and there won't be any oxtails this year for winter, and it will have to then come only next year because of the lead times in the shipments.
And we're talking, what, a matter of weeks here now, or days?
We're talking as soon as possible. So the issue is, does now sit with the department where they are negotiating between Argentina and South Africa. And we don't see it being resolved anytime soon. But that's why we are out here trying to push. They need to resolve it within the next couple of weeks at the least.
And if the issue is not resolved, what is the next move from your association?
So from us as an association, we always stand that we are happy to work with the Department of Agriculture. We're happy to engage with them, and we will continue to do so and give them as much information or support as they need to resolve this issue. So from us as an association, we just urge the Department of Agriculture just to resolve this, because otherwise, you know, people are just going to miss out on oxtails this year.
Etienne Nodia, thank you very much indeed, from the Association of Meat Importers and Exports South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, extreme weather, expensive vehicle repairs, failing infrastructure and cybercrime, all driving up insurance risks for South African households and businesses. Now, insurers say claims are becoming more frequent and more costly, while many policyholders remain underinsured or not insured at all, or exposed to risks that their policies simply don't cover. But how much of all of this situation is going to translate into higher premiums and tougher conditions? Someone squarely at the center of this debate is the Chief Executive Officer of PSG Insure, Cedric Masondo. A very warm welcome to you. And are insurers using climate risk and claims inflation just to prepare us for another round of steep premium increases in coming months?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think the insurance industry as a whole has really evolved. And I mean, if you just look at it, the data and the use of data and really help the insurers, just mainly on the risk selection, but also on the price, on the price pricing of the risk. So yes, the insurers are using data, dating back for years now, collecting that data, analyzing and pricing the risk properly.
Is there a single risk that has added the most to insurance costs during the first half of this year?
Jeremy, over the years, I think, let me just say, the last 10 years, we've been having this discussion about the changes in the climate change and the impact of climate change to ordinary people, whether it's just you own a farm or you own a house, and that how it translates into an increase in claims. So this year, the first 6 months was not an exception. We've seen, especially in the Western Cape and part of Eastern Cape, just the floods, driven by flood. And that resulted in some areas, big claims, flooding claims, property damage. So I can say that something that is not new, but we've seen just escalated, is the flood damage. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a new phenomenon, which is cyber risk, which is something new to all of us.
Let's get to cyber risk in a moment if we have time, but I'm interested in weather-related claims, which you say have increased, and we're all aware of what has happened in the Western Cape and in KwaZulu-Natal. But is there real evidence that shows it's a lasting shift that you would be worried about rather than just an unusually bad 6 months?
I mean, we collect data. All insurance companies collect data, and it's based on the number of claims, just the frequency of claims, and just the amount of claims. So what we've seen in the last 10 years, there's really an increase in the frequency. So you see a lot of claims, happening quite more often. But the impact seems to be big. If you just look at the Bredevere, the claims that we've just experienced in the Western Cape, some people say it was really more than the 1 in 100 event. So it's something that really will happen in our lifetime. And we've seen that quite a lot. So we are expecting El Nino, and the reports and the scientists are suggesting that will be the biggest El Nino. So it's massive drought and in some cases floods, so that's not usual. That is something that we've just seen in the last 10 years.
Are we close to a point, do you think, where people in those high risk areas eventually become uninsurable because that risk is simply too great?
I think it's difficult for me to answer those questions, but let me just attempt it. So there are places where people shouldn't be building this, and we've had cases where there've been floods and you trace back and you suppose that for years, those areas people should not have built in those areas. And I think that's something that needs to be enforced by the municipalities and make sure that those places remain not built. But I think for clients, it's something that will take a little bit more difficult because you need clients to understand that I'm living in a place which is prone to floods and I need to implement risk management. So it's a journey. I don't think we're there yet, but I think it's something that we need to educate ourselves and educate the clients and on those things.
Let me move away from the weather. You raise cybercrime. Your company suggests around 17% of businesses only have cyber cover, which is really worrying. Is the bigger problem cost? Is it complacency? Or do you think policies in that respect have become too technical and too complicated?
I think it's something new. It's something new for everyone. And it takes time for the client to realize that this can happen. And in some cases, you need to experience those cyber attack and lose money and something. So it's something new. And when something like that happens, it takes time for ordinary people to buy into insurance. Jeremy, insurance is a grudge risk. No one just think about buying insurance. It has to be something really that you want to do it and because you've impacted. So the numbers are low, but I do think I'm positive because the insurance industry has responded by product. Pricing will always be debatable because pricing depends on the data and the pie. But I do think it's something that's going to increase over the time.
When a company falls victim then to an AI-generated scam or a deep fake, how difficult is it to prove that the loss is covered?
So one of the good things about just having an insurance policy, a cyber insurance, it's not just that there's a payout, but it's the risk management that the insurance company will help you to introduce in your business to improve the risk management. So it makes it a little bit better when you've been part of that. And in some cases, even if you had a broker and the broker helps you to put the claim forward. I don't think we've had a problem with or dispute in terms of whether it's a claim or not. I just think the penetration is low. And these are the things that don't happen more frequent, and sometimes they don't even get publicized.
And just a final question. You also say that South Africa's insurance protection gap is widening. Cedric, is that because people simply cannot afford cover anymore, or because insurers such as yourself are simply excluding more risk?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, in those areas where the real problem with floods, and you expect floods, and then so insurance are de-risking, and you see less insurance companies playing part in those areas. Or in some cases where there's just risk, it's just too much, and the insurance are discrediting. If you look at, for example, if you're a farmer, especially an emerging farmer, things like drought, it's a very difficult cover, and there are very few insurance companies that write drought. And so that's the part, and that's mainly because there's the supply. But there is an issue of affordability of insurance. And I think that's in an economy like ours, that is a big issue where people just can't afford to buy insurance.
It does suggest, though, that, or ask the question, whether insurers are doing enough to offer affordable protection to lower income households or struggling households, or is the market, do you think, at this point simply leaving them behind?
I think for some of the risk, and it will be different if you talk to the life guys, because they've got very products geared for that. But I think if you look at just a typical motor insurance, I think most people are not buying insurance because of affordability. But the insurance defense is that the pie is not big enough, and there's high claims. You need to recover that. You need a sustainable insurance. So you need both. You need more people to buy insurance, and more people buying insurance, good infrastructure, no potholes on the roads. That really, I can guarantee you, that really lowers the premium, because there's much competition among the insurers to offer. Yeah.
Always comes back to potholes, doesn't it? Cedric Masondo, thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of PSG Insure. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Western Cape, I read, is set to get another aviation facility, but this time it's not the planned Cape Winelands Commercial Airport near Durbanville. Atlantic Aerodrome is opening in the Swartland in September. It's being developed as a dedicated premium base for private aircraft, for charter businesses, flight schools and general aviation operators. So let's explore a little bit more in detail with Rian Klein, who's the Managing Director of Atlantic Aerodrome. Rian, a very warm welcome. And what convinces you that the region, the area, needs another aerodrome rather than better use of the facilities it already has?
So we saw a clear gap in the market. General aviation has grown steadily over the last couple of years. And if I think back, it's always needed a dedicated or a more or better built infrastructure. We realized that we can actually build something that would serve the industry better compared to what is existing at the moment.
So how much firm demand, Rian, do you have today as opposed to maybe just expressions of interest at this point? I mean, are you going to start off positively?
Jeremy, to be honest, we are completely leased out, and we haven't even done our marketing or completed our marketing. At this stage, we were going to build phase one, and as the demand grows, we would have gone into phase two. And we've just started with phase two and just incorporating that into phase one.
I mean, that's astonishing, because it's also, Rian, a real barometer of the success and the growth potential of the entire provincial economy, is it not?
That's true.
So who do you think your core customer is going to be at launch? Is it the private aircraft owners I referenced in my introduction, charters, or the flight training market, or a combination of all of that?
So our focus is solely the general aviation sector. So if your listeners don't know what the difference is, if you go to a Cape Town International or a OR Tambo, that is essentially what I would call a bus depot. We are not that. We will be, our target market will include private aircraft owners and aviation businesses, you know, such as charter operators, your maintenance organizations and flight schools, like you've mentioned earlier. We're going to accommodate all of those guys, the smaller guys that often left out of the bigger airports, and they don't have the space to operate the way they need to.
Rian, the airport, as I understand it, and you know the geography better than I do, is around 40 minutes away from the central city. I've got to ask myself why an operator would accept that distance rather than remain closer to Cape Town International. Obviously, there's an advantage there. What is it?
Good question, Jeremy. So the location made a lot of sense to us for numerous reasons, actually. So we're close enough to Cape Town to be convenient. If you ever drove on the N7, it's a stunning road. It's dual carriageway. It's quite quick. So a lot of people have been asking me, geez, you know, it's 40, it's 50 kilometers away from Cape Town. It's too far. It's not. I promise you it will take you quicker to get there than to drive to Cape Town International with your traffic lights and congestion in the roads. But except for that, the convenience of a location, we are outside of the airspace of Cape Town International and outside of the airspace of the anticipated Cape Winelands Airport. And it gives us room to expand as demand will grow in the coming years.
And Rian, tell me, hangarage, fuel, handling costs, how would that compare with existing facilities around Cape Town?
So we're obviously building something premium here. This is not your average airfield with a dirt runway or somewhere out in the dust. We are spending quite a big amount to make this aerodrome a premium destination. But our facilities and our fuel and our hangarage, it will be on par with what you'll get at Cape Town International or at Cape Winelands International and the other existing aerodromes in the area. Obviously, we can't ask too much, but it will definitely be on par with what you're paying somewhere else.
I also read that your initial runway, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong here, just over 800 meters. What aircraft can realistically operate from it, particularly with useful and meaningful passenger and fuel loads?
Yes. So our initial runway length was supposed to be 884 meters. We are, like I've mentioned earlier, our phase two plan was to extend that runway to 1,261 meters. And that's exactly what we'd be doing now. And the type of aircraft you'll see there are not just your smaller airplanes. And that length, to give you an idea, it's longer than Cape Winelands International at the moment. It's an existing airport. It used to be called Visanta Kroll Airport. But you get quite a lot of quite big airplanes on there. The maximum load would be about 16 tons. So that will be for your turboprops and your selected light jets.
Are there still, Rian, approvals that are outstanding from the South African Civil Aviation Authority? Anything that could delay or even prevent full operations at this point?
Jeremy, all our approvals are in place. The only thing that we are still waiting for is our actual license for the aerodrome. It's not to be something of a concern. There's two ways that you can actually register or license your aerodrome. Under your subpart 5, which is what we are registering our aerodrome at, it's CAA, it means that we can either register it. Registration means you have a runway and you've got a windsock and you can operate. We are actually doing it and building it according to international standards, and we want the CAA to recognize that we are building it exactly to the international standards and specifications. And we've received from the CAA an email about a month ago saying that by middle of August, we will have our license.
And how are you addressing, Rian, issues like noise, maybe traffic, environmental concerns? Has there been any resistance from surrounding Swartland communities?
Do you know what? I was expecting quite a lot of issues from the surrounding neighbors, but not one single complaint I've been heard. This project has been in the works since 2012. Final environmental approvals were obtained in September of 2016. And since then, this project was delayed for a couple of years, but we've started with it February of this year. And the environmental compliance has been, you know, formed part of our project from the outset. We followed the required processes and we continue operating with the conditions of those approvals. But we are out in nowhere, but we don't have a lot of neighbors. We're out in the farmlands. It's stunning. It's between the mountains. We are, again, very conveniently located, not to be a burden or to bother people in the area.
And just finally, what kind of financial or operational milestone would you need to reach in year one to prove it's a viable hub rather than just an ambitious property development?
It's a very good question. I wouldn't necessarily measure the success of the Aerojet by the number of aircrafts. Neither would I measure the success whether my hangars are full or not. For me, a success for this business that we're building here, we need to create something that's sustainable. You know, an aviation hub where businesses can grow, and I don't want to have just an aerodrome where pilots and their crews or their families would come. I want this to be a destination. We can have restaurants, we can have bars. Everybody of the public, even if you're not a pilot or know a pilot, you're welcome. Come and have a drink, come and have a cup of coffee or a breakfast or lunch or supper. It's extremely difficult question to answer, but I know this is going to be successful. We've done our due diligence, and we are very excited for this to open.
Rian Klein, thank you very much indeed. He is the Managing Director of Atlantic Aerodrome. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.